Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to those who believe a car should stir one's emotions and deliver a heightened state of driving. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Eric Spanberg, in for Mike Collins. Today, it's our weekly local news roundup. Among the top stories we'll be discussing, the number of homicides in Charlotte now stands at 89, and it's possible that by the end of the year, that number could double the 58 homicides here in 2018. The school board selected its equity committee, and it's big enough to make a Democratic presidential debate look sparse by comparison. We'll also tell you about a major addition to the banking sector, what's happening with the local tree ordinance, and we'll explore why a conservative political group is running ads praising two high-profile Democrats. Yes, you heard that right, two high-profile Democrats. Plus several big sports stories, including the latest on Major League Soccer. Joining me today in studio are Jonathan Lowe from Spectrum News.
Good morning, Eric.
Good morning. Daniel Chimtob of the Charlotte Observer.
Good morning.
She coached me on it, and I still messed it up. I've had a bad week of names. WFAE's David Borax.
Hey, Eric.
Good morning. And Steve Harrison from WFAE.
Morning, Eric.
Good morning. All right, so let's start with the grim statistics. They keep getting worse. We've now had three deadly shootings in the last week, and they pushed Charlotte's homicide total to 89 for 2019. That's 30 more than all of last year. If the city avoided another homicide for the next 2 months, this year's total would still represent an increase of 52%. Let's start with Isaac Watrous. He had this to say after one of the deadly shootings at the Bojangles near South End, where he is a regular customer.
This is beginning to be a every week, every other day occurrence, and it's getting out of hand.
David, what is CMPD saying as this problem persists?
Well, you know, everybody looks to the police department to solve this problem, which is kind of a crazy idea that we would think the police could do this. Chief Kerr Putney and other officials there consistently this year have talked about the issue being people using guns to solve routine arguments. And in many of these cases, that's true. There are a fairly large number of domestic violence cases in this as well. But it's something that, you know, the police department alone cannot solve this. It's a community problem. And, you know, as you mentioned, we're way ahead of last year. We're ahead of 2 years ago when we had a recent high of 85 homicides. And we're on track to start pushing the record, which is 129 from 1993. And it's not a good statistic for the city.
Steve, one of the things that I've wondered about is, with this soaring increase in the number of homicides, it really has not seemed to impact the political races. This is a city elections year, and yet we don't hear a lot about that in a political context.
That's right. It hasn't really come up hardly at all. And in next month's election, I mean, a lot of it's already decided. But if you go back to the primaries in September, this was not a big issue. It is strange that you have these staggering numbers and that there hasn't been a candidate or a group of candidates that's made it a big issue. You know, I think one thing that's kind of and in addition, that the council itself has not really questioned the chief, questioned the police force, questioned any kind of leadership. And that's kind of how it is historically here. I mean, if you look at the organizational chart on paper in the city, the council is in charge, and then the manager, and then the chief. But in reality, the way it works is at the top of the org chart is often the chief. And sometimes council feels really deferential to that job, and that's what's happening now.
I was going to add to David's point where he left off with mentioning pushing the record from the 1990s. I've often asked CMPD, what's the difference between that crime wave and the one we're seeing this year? They will tell you that the one in the 1990s was fueled by drugs, especially crack cocaine. So they were essentially able to arrest their way out of that problem, and that's why we saw it, you know, take a dip. This time around, as David mentioned, we're seeing the root of the problem is people using, as he mentioned, gun violence to settle these small arguments. So I think the challenge is, how do you solve that? The difference there, how do you solve
it? Much harder to arrest your way out of it.
Correct.
Another story this week, school board making some news with a couple of moves. One was they named this equity committee, reviving it after, I think, about a 10-year hiatus, 39 members, which is a lot to say the least. And at the same time, they also gave the town of Cornelius a reprieve when it comes to school funding. David, I think you looked a little bit into that.
Yeah, if folks remember, the state legislature passed a bill last year that gave permission to some of the Mecklenburg County towns to open their own town-owned charter schools if they want. And this is playing into concerns that these towns have about not getting a fair shake from CMS when it comes to new school construction. And so those towns were Cornelius, Huntersville, Mint Hill, and Matthews. Several of those towns have started committees to look into the actual project of doing a charter school. In Cornelius, their committee came back and said, you know, really the best thing for us right now is to continue working with CMS. And the mayor has made some strong statements about being eager to work with CMS. And that seems to have been enough to convince the board to take Cornelius off of its bad list. And what they had said was the towns who are contemplating charter schools would go to the bottom of the list when it comes time for new construction projects. And so Cornelius is out of the doghouse. There's still the questions about the other ones and whether there'll be some moves there. In Huntersville, there are still politicians there who see political advantage in talking about splitting with CMS or starting charter schools. And so I don't think we're going to see anything there. You know, there is an audience for that in these towns, but it's not clear how big it is. And, you know,
I think the conversation has changed, though, a lot. I'm hearing a lot from CMS school board members and the officials in like Cornelius and Matthews. The conversation has softened from earlier this year when it was rather contentious, basically over HB 514, which allowed them to make their own municipal charter schools. Now I'm hearing a lot more of, we want to work with CMS, we want to try to do what we can to repair the relationship, because I think both sides see that that's not really a feasible idea, that it would just cost too much for these small towns to really split off from CMS and not, you know, have that support from them.
I thought it was interesting, though, David, the settlement, so to speak, for lack of a better term, Cornelius did not commit to a 15-year moratorium on charter schools, which is something that the school board had asked for. So it seems like there might be a little give on both sides here.
Absolutely. And, you know, another way to look at this is that the CMS really does want to work this out with the towns. They don't want to have a divided school district. As long as there are people out there calling for splitting, you know, it doesn't help them move forward with their planning. And
And that's what really, if you look at Matthews, that is what led to the town commissioner John Higdon running against Paul Bailey.
Oh, that's right.
To be mayor. Those two will be facing off in the general election. But John Higdon said that the deciding factor for him running against Paul Bailey was because of this municipal charter thing. So the last time that I talked to both of them, even Mayor Bailey said that he wants to try and work on the relationship with CMS.
Well, I'll tell you one thing we need in Charlotte, which is we need more banks. And Danielle, you're on the case. So U.S. Bank this week opening their first branch, I think, in the old Dean and DeLuca space uptown, correct?
Yes, that is correct.
So what's driving this? What made them want to come to Charlotte? Because this is just the first of, I think, 10 branches over the next couple of years?
Yeah, so it's 10 branches by the end of next year. You know, I mean, they talked a lot about, obviously, like many companies do, the growth of the area. They already have customers, even though they don't have retail branches in their other business lines. And they also talked about the competition and said that, in a way, that was kind of exciting for them. I think, you know, we have about 88% of the deposits in the area are held by Wells and Bank of America. So they have a pretty big challenge, and it's not just them. JP Morgan is also opening 20 branches. So, you know, they're really going to need to differentiate themselves and come in and draw some of those customers away.
And one of the things that I thought was interesting in your story, you're talking about how while there was this sentiment that branches are dead, they're not dead.
Yeah, I mean, they talked about, you know, people want to be able to do, of course, technology is really important. I mean, obviously, they have to have mobile banking, and people want to be able to do as much as they can on their phone. But what the executives there told me is that, and Bank of America opened a new branch, too, and they said some of the same things. You know, with the really important transactions, people want to still have a face-to-face interaction. So the way they're designing these branches is kind of combining the two. You know, they even teach you how to use the app in the branch. So maybe
you can get coffee.
You're a little
some
bit,
of them
yeah.
Are baristas. I mean, there's
yeah. So
are we all going to start hanging out at bank branches?
Yeah,
maybe.
I guess so.
No. If they hand out money,
popular
I definitely will.
I like that idea.
Yeah.
I like that idea. Let's go to Exhibit A of politics makes strange bedfellows. It arrived in Charlotte this week in the form of a new TV campaign ad backed by a conservative group called Truth and Prosperity. Here's part of the message.
When partisans tried to deny the Republican National Convention from being held in Charlotte, Lyles and Isold stood firm, advocating the economic benefits the convention would bring to small businesses across Charlotte. Vi Lyles, Julie Isold, proven leaders leading Charlotte.
Steve, that's a little bit unusual because Vi Lyles and Julie Isold, last I checked, are Democrats. What's going on?
They are Democrats, and Truth and Prosperity is a conservative PAC that's raised money for Dan Forrest or to support Dan Forrest. And this ad is running on cable TV. And right, so Julie Isold first heard about it. She was really confused. She had no idea who this group is, why they're running this ad about her. And for her, I guess for the mayor is a shoo-in. The mayor supported the RNC, but this really means nothing. For Julie Isold, who voted to host the RNC in this city, that was a tough vote. And so I think when you have this commercial reminding people of that vote, that's just that's a little bit of a difficult, uncomfortable situation to bring that back.
So do we think this was done in a vindictive way? Was it done in a positive way? What's your sense of—
So Truth and Prosperity, you know, really hasn't said much. They kind of refer to their statement on their website, which is we support candidates that hold these values. And I mean, I don't think it is. I don't think there's any trickery here. I think this was a genuine effort of like that they felt like this was a bipartisan action on the council, or at least on the mayor and Julie Isold's part, and they wanted to support them. I mean, I think that's it. But I think that, you know, in this city that is overwhelmingly Democratic, it's just it's a challenge. And
I
so
agree. I agree with that. I mean that both of those ladies, I mean, I think they have a lot of support on the ground as far as Republicans are concerned. But, that puts Julie Isold in a really tough spot.
And she'll win. I mean, she is going to win re-election because there's four at-large seats, Democrats and one Republican. So she's going to win. I mean, 99.9% sure. Yep. But the big thing in this race is the bragging rights of where you finish and the totem pole. And, you know, you want to finish first or
who's
second.
Who's going to be mayor pro tem?
Who's going to be mayor pro tem? And so it's such an inside baseball thing with this election. But for the people on council, it's a really big deal.
Very fascinating.
Yeah, no, that I thought that was really interesting. And also, why no James Mitchell, for example? Why not the rest of the council members, the Democrats who voted for this?
You know, that is a really good point, right? Because James— Exactly. I mean, he was.
I mean, is there a bigger cheerleader for RNC and economic development?
Wasn't he out in front too, doing interviews when they were trying to sell Charlotte being a host city? I think he was out in front.
Oh yeah.
So it's interesting.
Yeah. I mean, I just wonder if he looked at this and said, "Actually, thanks for ignoring me."
Yeah. I mean, that's a good point.
Right.
But you know, in addition, just to the outside of the RNC, James Mitchell has always been incredibly supportive of, like, business development,
right?
Economic development issues. He has never wavered on that. And you're right. Why wasn't he thanked as well?
And I'm trying to think. So in that 6-5 vote, I guess Larkin Eggleston would also figure into that.
That's right.
Right? Mm-hmm. Now Greg Phipps is stepping away, but that would be the entire list of Democrats who could have been included. Right.
Right. Right. Right.
Has the mayor said much about this one way or another?
I haven't heard from the mayor on this at all. And kind of like I said, for her, she is so far in this election, so far above the fray in a way that
she doesn't need to say anything, really.
Yeah.
Got it. Okay. And obviously, we're into early voting. Election day is November 5th. When we come back, we're going to delve a little more into city politics. There is a new tree ordinance, or there is a new version of the tree ordinance. Those stories and more. Stay with us here on the Local News Roundup on Charlotte Talks.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to Mazda's focus to ensure every element of a car is designed around the driver. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.
Back on Charlotte Talks, I'm Eric Spanberg in for Mike Collins, and this is the Local News Roundup. Today, our panel consists of David Borax from WFAE Danielle Shimtob from the Charlotte Observer, Jonathan Lowe from Spectrum News, and Steve Harrison from WFAE. We have a little more city council news. Danielle, you were covering the changes to the tree ordinance, which is always a particularly sensitive topic in Charlotte, which has a lot of pride in its trees. So what did council do?
Yeah, so this is an amendment to the existing tree ordinance, and it applies to these urban zones, which are only about 4% of the city, but it's all of uptown and a lot of the areas along the light rail. And what it does is the city wants to give flexibility for developers to put the trees on their sites in these urban areas, because what they're saying is, you know, look, we don't have the space to put, you know, these tree save areas in such tight quarters in uptown. So what ends up happening is that they're paying a fee in lieu, and then they're going out. The city has a fund and goes out, takes, they use the money, go out and buy areas of land, but they're not in the city. So their goal is, look, we want to put more trees in uptown in the first place. So what it does is they can put trees in, you know, planters, in parking decks, kind of interesting. But the environmental advocates, you know, some of them are saying, look, the trees are not going to grow as big in a pot, obviously, and, you know, they're worried about the canopy going down in general because the city is also now backing away from their goal of having 50% tree canopy cover by 2050.
This to me is a – oh, go ahead, David.
I was just going to say a little bit of background on that. The city has done studies a couple of times in recent years about the size of the tree canopy, and in 2012 it covered 47.1% of the city, and 2016 study found that it was 46.8%, so we lost about 500 acres of trees. And so anytime rules changes are proposed that give developers more flexibility, folks who care about the trees here start to worry that that might mean that we'll lose trees and we'll lose more. And we are going to lose more trees. You know, and the development is not stopping. So,
and trees are, I mean, it's, they're not, it's not, they're not just there to look at. It's, I mean, they're, I've lived in Phoenix, Arizona. They don't have very many trees, and it's really, really hot. I mean, it controls our temperature. It keeps our air clean. So, I mean, they're really important for just our local environment and making sure that like that 50% by 2050 goal, they put that in place for, you know, a specific reason.
And the folks at the city are saying, you know, that 50% goal is going to be very difficult to meet, and maybe we should be thinking about it differently. Mm-hmm. And I think this proposal is part of their effort to come up with something different. So, as you mentioned, it only covers some areas, Danielle. I think it's about 4% of the city would be covered by these new rules. And, you know, if it does get some more trees in areas where we don't have them, maybe that's a good thing. The city insists that this will not result in a net loss of trees.
But it is worth noting that, you know, this is one little piece, and they're saying we are going to come out with a broader revamp of the tree ordinance as part of this whole unified development ordinance.
Which is really important for people that, you know, that's not just bureaucraties. That really matters.
I know it sounds very technical. Yeah.
That decides how things are built, where they're built.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. And so that's where this 50% goal is probably going to come up a lot more. You know, people are they're saying that they want to basically have more neighborhood-specific goals, whether or not that's 50%, whether or not it even is a percentage, we don't really know yet. But they're saying, hang on, we're going to do more. This is only one piece.
And it would be really interesting to see, you know, if they – could we do that 50% goal in other parts of town?
Yeah.
Like University City would be a good example. There are still parts of University City that are still pretty rural, and they're, you know, whole – tracts of land where it's just nothing but trees and forests. So, you know, is that an option would be, you know, a question that I have.
And that was this for all of us who have been to council meetings, and that's everyone at this table. It's a classic council debate. They go on for an hour. Everybody's at war. Votes 9-2.
And they've already discussed it in committee prior to.
Right. The two no's, by the way, were Dimple Ejmyr and Matt Newton, I believe.
Yes.
Is that right? Political news in Raleigh this week, Steve. More discussion of redistricting reform and also an important decision on the gerrymandering case. What's going on with each of those?
So earlier this fall, the state's House and Senate maps were declared to be gerrymanders and had to be redrawn. Though that was done very quickly. We are very close to having that finished. If the three-judge panel signs off on that, that will be finished. So now we move to the second phase, which is the congressional map, which we have 13 seats. It is a 10-3 Republican advantage. Just because there's fewer seats, that is a much more effective gerrymander. And those maps are being challenged in state court. by Democratic voters. And I think the big news this week was that there was a decision that this lawsuit will stay in state court as opposed to going to federal court. That's what the essentially what the Supreme Court said earlier this year, that this is a state issue, and keeping it in state court is more favorable to Democrats.
I was going to say, so that for the Republican leadership in the state legislature, that's why they don't want it to stay in state court.
That's right, because ultimately if you go to the North Carolina Supreme Court, Democrats have a 6-1 advantage, so this is much friendlier turf for them.
And on the redistricting piece, I think there were three bills that were heard in the House committee. In essence, what they're trying to get to, or what they say they're trying to get to, is nonpartisan redistricting.
That's correct? Right. So you'd have some of these options would be creating an independent commission or group that would take this out of legislators' hands. And that was something that I think even before a lot of these big court decisions earlier this year had been talked about, but I think the chances were pretty small earlier this year. But now that the state House and Senate maps have been declared unconstitutional, I think there's a much greater chance that you could have independent map drawing happen in North Carolina.
Got it. That's the voice of Steve Harrison from WFAE. We're on the local news roundup. Jonathan Lowe from Spectrum News, Danielle Shimtob from the Charlotte Observer, and David Borax from WFAE are with me today. Jonathan, I want to ask you a little bit about what is happening in Huntersville. You went up to a town council meeting to hear an update about this cluster of eye cancer cases. Nobody's really been able to figure it out. What's the latest in terms of trying to discern what's going on up there?
So it was pretty disappointing for the people up in that area that are really concerned about what's causing this possible cluster of dozens of cases. I believe there are 12 eye cancer cases up in that area. So Monday, the town commission got the results of soil sample tests and tissue sample tests. The soil sample tests were taken from four different locations: Hopewell High School, North Mech Park, Fire Station 3, and the third one the Nature Preserve. Thank you, David. the interesting thing, they bored down 3 feet, but they only took the first foot of soil, tested that, found no contaminants, no sign of coal ash. The tissue samples, they were looking for any sort of signs of genome mutation. They didn't find anything there. So basically, they're back to the drawing board. The retired ophthalmologist that is working really closely with Auburn University, because the same cluster is being studied down in Alabama, said that the next step basically now is blood samples, taking fresh serum from the people that are affected to see if there's anything there. But that's expensive and timely. The interesting thing with this, Eric, is that State Senator Natasha Marcus, who represents North Mecklenburg County, she in the budget requested $100,000 to help continue the research, because the grant that paid for this testing that they just got the results from, that money is being depleted. So she requested $100,000 in budget. It was in both the Republican and the governor's budget, so the money is there.
But
the standoff is holding up that money.
There's no budget approved. Staying in North Mecklenburg, but moving to a much happier story. David, I have to ask you about one of my favorite stories of the week. It took place in Kannapolis, and it's about a whole new ball game. What's going on up there?
A whole new ball game, right. So the minor league baseball team there, the Kannapolis Intimidators, they've had that name for a number of years. Intimidator was the nickname of Dale Earnhardt Sr., and he is beloved in town. He's a native son there, and folks were really enamored of that name. They sold out the final game of the season last year when they knew that the team is going to be moving into a new stadium downtown. So the other night here in Kannapolis, they had a big unveiling for a new name for the team, because the ownership has changed and they want to get fresh start on things. And they have said that they can't use the Intimidator name in the way they want to for marketing and merchandising, because they don't own the name. The family owns the name. And they've talked to the family about it. And, you know, Dale Earnhardt Jr. says it's sad that this era has to come to an end. But anyway, big party at the Gem Theater. It's packed with people. There's thousands of people downtown for this carnival. They showed a video about the history of Kannapolis and the teams. And the ultimate announcement was the Kannapolis Cannonballers.
The Cannonballers.
A cheer went up from the crowd. The Cannonballer mascot is this figure who is kind of like a daredevil with a baseball head who would be shot out of a cannon at a circus. And it's colorful. It's red, white, and blue. The Cannonballer has a Dale Earnhardt mustache.
Nice touch.
The number 3, which was Dale Earnhardt's car number, figures prominently in their merchandising and logo. And so they've managed to hold on to the spirit of Dale Earnhardt, but they are changing the name. From the people I talked to the other night, it's a big hit. Some folks on social media have placed some not so kind comments about it. It does pay homage to the history of the city. Remember, the Cannon Mills was the major employer in Kannapolis for so many years, and so Cannonballers invokes that. I mean, the word ballers is kind of a new slang for ball game players of any kind, and there, as the owner Andy Sandler told me, there are lots of opportunities for marketing and merchandising, and he feels really good about it. The mayor, Daryl Hinnant, really loved it as well, and I'll tell you, it was a great party the other night.
Well, so, David, if they were going for some slang, they'd have to spell it B-A-L-L-A-Z.
Ballers.
Yes. That's yes. Right. See, they need Jonathan to consult on this. Who needs the Nationals and the Astros when we have the Cannonballers? By the way, so Kannapolis gets a new ballpark in 2020. Charlotte gets the Republican National Convention. Steve, it's been quiet on the RNC front, but we are looking at the likelihood of perhaps a very unusual convention in that you may have a president who is coming off of impeachment hearings, and you have a pivotal figure from Charlotte who is right in the middle of all this. I want to play a clip from Fox News Sunday. This is Chris Wallace in an exchange with Acting Chief of Staff Mick Mulvaney, who grew up in Charlotte.
The fact is, not only did the press think you said it, here's what a statement that was put out by a senior Justice Department official. If the White House was withholding aid in regards to the cooperation of any investigation of the Department of Justice, that is news to us. Everybody thinks that that's what you said.
Never use that language, because there is not a quid pro quo.
You were asked by Jonathan Carl, you described a quid pro quo, and you said that happens all the time.
And reporters will use their language all the time. So my language never said quid pro quo.
So, quid pro quo. I'm not going to make you answer that, but I am curious, what are you hearing about this convention that has been pitched locally in a very Democratic city as a tourism event, as a public relations event, as something that generates business and is not about politics when you have this going on?
Who
as the
says
backdrop?
It's not about politics?
Well, I mean, that's the argument, though, from
yeah,
the,
I mean,
from
but that's right? I mean, you're right, David. But yeah. That was what I mean. That was one of the lines when this was debated. Some of this people would say this is not Donald Trump's convention.
Right.
Of course,
it's about process. When they talked about politics, they would say it's about
and
the
that
process,
led to a lot of eye rolls because, of course, it's about President Trump's renomination. But having said that, like Eric said, we may be coming off an impeachment inquiry. Maybe even, I mean, it's definitely possible the removal of a president. And so, I mean, if in theory, if that happened, then this would be kind of validate everything that the supporters said in a way, that this is all about process and not about the president. You know, right now we are in a little bit of a lull period in terms of the convention. Things will kind of pick up again in 2020. And I would assume that there are going to be more moments when the city council is put on the spot again about this, about
right.
Their decision to host. Remember this summer, they took the vote to condemn the president's statements after Greenville. I would not be surprised if there are more votes like that as we get forward, that they feel like they need to go on the record again.
I'm going to put you on the spot here a little bit. You and I were both here in 2012 when the Democratic National Convention came to Charlotte. And I need to go back and look because I can't document. I can't document at the moment. But based on memory, it seemed like they were a little more active just around town in the year leading into the convention.
I think that's right. I mean, one of the big things was the legacy projects.
Right.
Right, like what will be the legacy of the convention? Because I think, you know, Anthony Fox was mayor. It was, in a way, he was the main person. This was going to be the biggest moment of his tenure. And so, yeah, there was just a lot more talk. The city wanted to talk about it.
Yeah, and maybe that's part of the reason. I mean, I know they are going to talk about legacy projects at some point, but maybe it's because Anthony Fox was so close to the Obama White House. Maybe it was just a more natural fit.
That's right. And so, you know, I know with the RNC this time, they are, you know, their big push right now is the 8,000 volunteers. Mm-hmm. And I spoke to them this week. They said they're, you know, I don't want to use the word right on track, right? Let's not use that one from 2012. But they said they're about halfway there. Okay.
And they won't give it. We've asked that too, Stephen. They won't give a number on where they are in the process. They'll just say we're halfway there. We're doing well. We're
same with fundraising. Although they've said they're doing very well, but I have not been able to get a number yet. Anyway, let's go back to North Mecklenburg, David. You were covering the story about Atrium Health wanting to build a new hospital in Cornelius. How big would it be, and what's the likelihood that they can win approval for that?
So they filed an application with the state for a certificate of need. That's basically they have to demonstrate that there is a need for this hospital in that area. They want to do a 30-bed hospital with two operating rooms right off of I-77 there. This hospital would give the Atrium a presence there in North Mecklenburg that they don't have right now. Apart from that, their closest hospitals are in Concord and Charlotte. This would compete with Novant Hospital Presbyterian in Huntersville and with Lake Norman Regional Medical Center in Cornelius, both of which are bigger. I think the Novant Hospital has about 139 beds. Somebody said 30 beds, it seems like a really tiny hospital. But remember, when Novant opened in Huntersville, they had 50 beds, and they have applied since then to add beds as the need has grown there. I think Atrium is looking at the North Mecklenburg Lake Norman area as a growing area, and there's going to be a need in the future for more beds, and they want to be in that game. So I think it's going to cost about $150 million if it's approved. Still needs to go through zoning approval. It's on a site in Cornelius that was supposed to be this massive mixed-use development called Augusta Lee. And Augusta Lee failed at the time of the recession, 2008-2009. It just completely fell apart, and I think the city of the town of Cornelius would love to see something on that site, and a hospital seems like a good solution, although we have to remind everybody that a hospital probably will not pay taxes. So,
That's a good point. But it does seem, given the track record of that site, they would probably take this. It's better than nothing, obviously,
that's
right?
And I think having a hospital there, it's an employer, you know, and that would be something else that Cornelius needs right now. They're trying to solve some economic development and disparity issues with folks who live in town. So,
did they get into yet any kind of projected employee numbers or wages or anything like that?
I didn't see that number. Those numbers. They have not put out a lot of information yet. It's still just in the application phase. So.
Got it. Very good. When we come back, we've got to get into Major League Soccer. That's now mandatory in Charlotte. We have to talk about Major League Soccer every week.
I'm in.
You're in? Very good. And also, a lot of rail news this week. Light rail, high-speed rail, whatever kind of rail you want, it is certainly under consideration. Stay with us here on the Local News Roundup on Charlotte Talks.
I'm Mike Collins. Mecklenburg voters are deciding the Arts and Science Council's request for a quarter-cent sales tax increase to help shore up the arts and culture sector.
Organizations are in crisis and they might be lost.
If approved, there would be new funding for the arts and money for parks and greenways and schools. But some question if a sales tax hike should be for other needs.
To me, the big community problem is affordable housing.
We'll hear from both sides in a Charlotte Talks forum Monday, October 28th at 7 p.m. at the McGlowan Theater. Registration and details at WFAE.org.
Back on Charlotte Talks, I'm Eric Spanberg, and we are in the Local News Roundup. My panel includes Danielle Shimtob of the Charlotte Observer, David Borax from WFAE, Jonathan Lowe from Spectrum News, and WFAE's Steve Harrison. Danielle, you wanted to focus on business this week. I fully embrace that idea. So let's talk a little bit about some real estate news involving City Council this week. Crescent Communities won approval for a big project in the Elizabeth neighborhood, and people who were fans of, is it Jackalope Jacks? Did I get the name right?
Mm-hmm.
Will know this site well. So what's going on?
Yeah, so the former Jackalope Jacks site, originally there were supposed to be plans for apartments there. The original plan that developer, it was a different developer, had did not win over the community, so they ended up having to change it, and then they said that the economics didn't work anymore for the project. So this is kind of the latest development for the site. So City Council approved on Monday. It's going to be office and retail for four stories of office and retail. And I think, you know, this is like really in the key intersection of Elizabeth. This is right at Caswell and 7th Street, and you know, it seemed to be well received by the community. I went to a community meeting for it a couple months ago. So, you know, it's going to be really interesting to see kind of how that evolves. It's really just that one that one stretch with, you know, this site and the Stanley and some of the other businesses around there is sort of the core of that neighborhood.
And what's our timetable on this?
I believe that they're going to start in the second quarter of next year. That was the latest estimate that I've been given. And it should wrap up by 22, I think.
Got it. Very good. Speaking of construction, anyone who's visited the airport in, say, the last 100 years might notice there's a lot going on out there. They made some announcements this week about more changes. What's changing at the airport?
So the traffic shift. They reopened some lanes both at...
Not for the planes, for cars, right? Sorry.
Yes. So they opened up travel lanes... both at departure and arrival. So just another traffic shift that people need to be prepared for. Traffic still an issue as far as backups, just because there's so much going on out there. But, you know, don't anyone think that because this is the final traffic shift that the construction is going to be ending at the airport.
And the and the reason for the shift, I mean, the roadway is moved away from the terminal, yep. And they are going to be starting really soon on this massive 5-year project to rebuild and expand the terminal.
$600 million, right, for the lobby?
I mean, just an incredibly complex...
Nice lobby.
...complex project. And, and kind of in addition to that, you know, there's still the plans for the fourth parallel runway. Mm-hmm. And I was reading in the Charlotte Ledger this morning, the newsletter, that American has said they want to add even more flights to Charlotte. They want to take some of the regional jets and make them, you know, kind of the bigger mainline planes like 737s, et cetera. So, growth is not.
Yeah, it's just going to continue at the airport.
I thought it was interesting with the traffic shift and the stories about that this week. The rideshare is getting a designated zone. You know, a lot of these city plans like never considered at all that rideshare would exist, and that's what, you know, the airport said as well. So I think it'll be interesting to see not just how that plays out at the airport, but how that plays out into planning and all sorts of other, you know, initiatives that maybe started a couple years ago and then Uber and Lyft have exploded since then.
Got to have room for the rideshare. We're speaking about the airport. Flight brings us to Air Jordan, and that's how I'm going to get you to the Charlotte Hornets opener on Wednesday. The Hornets, according to 538.com, have a 6% chance of reaching the playoffs. That's not good if you're not a sports fan, by the way. But on Wednesday night, P.J. Washington, their top rookie draft pick, set an NBA record with 7 three-pointers, and the Hornets came away victorious. Here's a little bit of what happened.
P.J. Washington!
Welcome to the league, young fella.
Washington. Oh, my! Washington. Corner three, Washington. His fourth triple, P.J. Washington.
My word.
What a debut.
Wow.
So they're undefeated, and there are only 81 games left.
He set the bar really high for the rest of the season.
And for himself. 7 right. Three-pointers. I think he hit his first three. Imagine starting your career that way, coming out boom, 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 and people are comparing you to the big stars of the past. The Hornets really need a player like this, and I really hope that he can keep the momentum going, because it will turn fans on, and it'll keep the city's excitement about the team alive. You know, as you mentioned, the chances of them making the playoffs are not put to be very high, but... You know, teams do this all the time. They come out of nowhere and they surprise everyone. And you know, it's really fun to watch when that happens. And,
although Eric, do you still get Sports Illustrated, Eric?
I see it when I go to the
dentist. So I was looking at the NBA preview, and you talked about the 6% chance, and they mentioned they're right up on the Hornets, and they had a quote from an opposing scout who said, "This may very well may be the worst roster in the league." So.
Oh my God. You know what that was? That was a great promo for tonight's home game against the Minnesota Timberwolves. Steve Harrison just said.
You're welcome.
All right, so he is not predicting 82-0. one other sports story to get to, which is, as I mentioned, mandatory mention of Major League Soccer. So this week, MLS awarded Sacramento an expansion team that is number 29 in MLS. This was widely expected, but this begins the clock, so to speak, on franchise number 30. They've said they will have 30 teams. So, David, you're a big soccer guy. Is Charlotte now at the front of the line?
I would think they are. I think St. Louis is still in the mix, but they have some issues with the stadium. And David Tepper, the Panthers owner, is pushing really hard to get a team right now. I think he's got a full court press, to use another sports analogy. But, He is talking with the city right now about trying to get some money to do some facilities here. We've been talking about this on the program almost every week, but he wants $100 or $200 million from the city to do a facility that would include a headquarters for a team here. Obviously, they would play at the stadium. Last week, we talked about it on this program. They might be looking at Eastland Mall as a place for a training facility. I think that, that the Panthers and Tepper are doing everything they can, and I think as far as the MLS goes, you know, they have said Charlotte would be a great place for a team, and they are looking at how quickly Tepper can check off all the boxes that they're looking for. So, you know, the stadium is one. The, having a facility like a training facility that can help bring in fan interest and maybe some retail and that sort of thing. All of those things are going to play into this. The Panthers already have some potential sponsors lined up. For example, Ally Bank wants to put its name on their uniforms. We don't even have a team yet. So I
think,
you know, all of the pieces are falling into place. There is no timetable for this. So we have no idea if it's going to happen as a Christmas present for Charlotte or we have to wait until after the Republican convention.
Steve, you obviously have followed many of these projects when they're calling for public money. What's your sense of the appetite or willingness of this city council to provide some money for training headquarters and some stadium modifications?
Big appetite. Yes. I mean, I think, you know, the question of how much money. But one thing I think that's interesting is that so they're probably going to look for hotel motel taxes, the tourism taxes, to at least start the process. And so the city has been they did some modeling, debt modeling 2 years ago to show how much money they had. They projected they would have then, and they have not updated or at least have not publicly released it. And so council, when you talk to them, they'll say things like, we need to keep how much money we have a secret to help our negotiating with David Tepper. But, you know, the flip side is, and kind of the assumption is that if he knows we have $200 million, we'll have to give him $200 million. But that's really not the case.
Is it a Jedi mind trick that we're working with here?
You know, you can have $500 million and just say, no, we're not going to give it to you. So I just think it's kind of a funny, because, you know, in some of these past sports deals, right, remember with the BB&T ballpark and the Knights, everything was public, everything was out in the open. And just, you know, council would say, no, that's too much money. We're going to go back. But here they feel like they are at such a disadvantage with David
Tepper.
It's
like, you know, have a poker face. Like, I can look at Steve. I have $200 million, Steve. I look pretty serious, don't I? I mean, you
know, just. And I know you don't have a penny over $150 million on you right now.
Come on.
I know that.
Come on now. I'm a journalist.
I think it'll be interesting to look at, like, how their appetite changes with the fact that Eastland might be in the mix because they've been trying to redevelop that site for so long. You know, it's 80 acres. They own it. And, you know, it definitely could play into their sort of effort to revitalize that part of town, which hasn't seen the economic growth that the rest of the city has seen.
And Eastland, when you do an Eastland 2, it allows you, I think it makes it easier to do the property tax rebates, where, you know, you have the hotel motel taxes on one hand, but the Eastland thing, you would say, okay, you're going to build this and we're going to give you 90%, you know, this is a little speculative, but 90% of your property taxes back over 10 years. It just gives them another angle, another way to put money into it.
I mean, based on Steve, what you and Danielle are saying, it seems like in some ways this could provide a lot of political cover for council because the Eastland project has gone nowhere. We've seen repeated failures. If they're able to bring in this high profile magnate and say, look, we're doing something that's really for a part of the city that needs help and economic development, wouldn't that make it an easier case for them?
Yeah. Absolutely.
And there has been discussion in the past about that site, the Eastland site, and using motel, hotel, tourism taxes to do some kind of a project there. I mean, in one of the iterations of the projects for this was to do something that included a soccer facility and entertainment facility. And I think the assumption with those projects would be that they would use some of this money. So, and again, this is not general fund revenue, you know, property taxes. This is money that is set aside for projects that are deemed to be the kind that would bring in tourism dollars. So,
but we can't tell you how much is available.
That's right, okay. Because he'll take it all.
Yes, I just wanted to make sure I had that right. So that is training centers. I love terrible puns, so let's go to trains. Monday night, City Council is going to consider approving $50 million to start to figure out how a 26-mile light rail line running from Matthews into Gaston County along Independence Boulevard, through Uptown, through the airport,
would work. Do I have all that right?
Yes.
That's right.
It's a significant vote.
Help me make the trains run on time here. What's going on?
So that is a $50 million payment to just start the design phase. I will mention that when this first came up, the Republicans on the council and even some of the Democrats were, you know, put off by they would have to make this vote. $50 million starts the process.
We don't. By the way, let me interrupt you. We don't know how much, right, Jonathan? Right. There's not a final price tag.
We can only base it off of how much the blue line and the blue line extension costs. But that was years ago. Construction costs have, you know, gone up significantly since then. But this vote that they will take next week will certainly could start the process. Now, the complicated thing is with the blue line.
Wait, that was the easy part? Okay, go
correct.
Ahead.
The thing that they're facing, it has to do with the county. So, you know, with the blue line, part of that was funded. It was funded federal dollars, but a lot of it came from a sales tax. Well, we are now going to be voting on, here in Mecklenburg County, a sales tax hike for arts, parks, and education. So if voters approve that, then the city will be barred and won't be able to use sales tax revenue. They won't be able to raise the sales tax again because of state law. There's a statute that we will hit the max at 7.5%. So where would the other part of that funding for the Silver Line come from?
So they could, I mean, yeah, that's right. They could go, they would have to ask Raleigh for permission.
Right.
They'd have to go
to the state.
By the way, Steve, I don't want to flaunt my deductive powers, but that might be difficult.
And I think especially, right, if the quarter cent is already taken, you know, that'll be it. And I think one thing that's interesting going back to this $50 million vote, if you go back 20 years ago when the first blue line was built, the process was reversed. The Hafson sales tax was approved by voters in 98, so they had the money. They had the funding. Like this, the train could happen. Then they started spending money to kind of fine-tune it, to do the design, to see how much it would cost. And this way, it's kind of being done in the reverse. They're going to spend the $50 million early and then worry about how to pay for it later.
Correct.
So
and the fear is that you get that far down the track, sorry, have to do it, yep. And then you can't come back, right?
Correct. Councilman Tariq Bakari used the, you know, once this train leaves the station, it's gone.
Man, we're going to have so many awful puns. It's going to be a delight.
But he was absolutely serious. Yeah. If the council approves this next week, there's no going back.
But we do need to know the cost before we move forward on this.
Absolutely.
And you don't get
that.
Seems
reasonable.
You don't get that. I mean, imagine you're building a house and you want to know how much it's going to cost. You got to hire an architect. This is the equivalent of hiring an architect to find out how much it's going to cost. And you might get the architect's plans and say, whoa, you know, it's more than we thought. I mean, the conventional wisdom right now is that it's at least a few billion dollars to build this
line. Billions.
And there will be participation from the federal government, the state, and so they would have to look at how to amass those funds, including a possible mm-hmm. sales tax increase.
But I believe federal and state funding has been declining for transportation.
Right.
So this time around, rather than when they built the blue line, they're going to have to contribute more or get creative with these other ways to find funding as opposed to relying on.
And in the debate last week, one of the council, Republican Ed Driggs, his complaint was he had a pretty good point. He was saying, like, well, we don't know how much it's going to cost. It might be $3 billion, it might be $3.5 billion, might be $4 billion. Mm-hmm. But he was saying that extra billion doesn't really matter. He wanted some cats in the city to offer some kind of rough draft plan for how it would be paid for.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Whether,
absolutely.
You know, he says the extra $500 million, that's kind of a rounding error at this point. He's like, just give us some idea of how we're going to do this. And really, so far, the city has been really reluctant
And Katz is really pushing, and I'll leave it with this point. You know, voters are looking at a possibility of voting for, you know, this arts, parks, and education, which is important. And on the other side, you've got affordable housing and public transportation.
There you go. In like three words, what about the high-speed rail from Atlanta to Charlotte?
So three options. You can go on the Georgia Department of Transportation website. They're still looking for public comment till November 4th. Three different options, one north of I-85 corridor, one along the I-85 corridor, one south. The best option would get you to Atlanta from Charlotte in 2 hours and 6 minutes.
You get the last word. Jonathan Lowe from Spectrum News, Steve Harrison from WFAE, Danielle Shimtob from the Charlotte Observer. David Borax from WFAE. I'm Eric Spanberg in for Mike Collins. Thanks for joining us for Charlotte Talks.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that share Mazda's passion that cars make driving matter. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.